This is the Berkeley Signal.
Presents complete nationwide coverage of tonight's Election 72.
Elizabeth Holtzman was elected to the House of Representatives from New York in 1972 at the age of 31, which made her at the time the youngest woman ever elected to the U.S. Congress. It turned out to be a fateful moment to join that august body.
The country tonight is in the midst of what may be the most serious constitutional crisis in its history. The president has fired the special Watergate prosecutor, Archibald Cox. Because of the president's action, the attorney general has resigned.
As the Watergate scandal deepened, Holtzman, as a member of the House Judiciary Committee, found herself at the very center of the action.
All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Ms. Holtzman.
Aye.
Mr. Owens.
Aye.
And so it had happened for the first time in 107 years. A committee of the House had recommended the impeachment and removal from office by the Senate of a president.
President Nixon reportedly will announce his resignation tonight.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
The impeachment process worked. Nixon, of course, jumped before being pushed. And this week, 44 years after Elizabeth Holtzman played a part in bringing down the 37th president, she has a new book out on why we should impeach number 45. In the case for impeaching Trump, Holtzman describes the current occupant of the Oval Office as, quote, a clear and present danger to our democracy. President Trump's actions, she writes, are indicative of a president who has established a different standard of justice for himself, exactly the kind that we declared impermissible in Nixon's articles of impeachment. He has done so at the expense of democracy, and he's done so at his own peril. Elizabeth Holtzman, thanks for joining me on Deconstructed. You've written this new book, The Case for Impeaching Trump, which came out on Monday. Give us your basic summary, your main argument as to why you believe there is a case for impeaching Trump even before Robert Mueller produces his final report on Trump and Russia.
There's enough information in the public arena to start an inquiry into whether Trump should be impeached. I don't know that we're ready for an impeachment vote at the moment because we need to inform the public and mobilize the public in with regard to the evidence that we have. No one's really put out a blueprint of how impeachment could happen, and that's what this book tries to do.
And I'm glad you've written, and I'm glad you mentioned the public because, yeah, impeachment doesn't come falling out of the sky. You have to make the case for it like anything else in a democracy.
Correct. And that's what happened during Watergate. I served on the House Judiciary Committee during the impeachment process against Richard Nixon. That process was not started by a gotcha movement in the House of Representatives or the Senate. And it wasn't started by a special prosecutor who had political ambitions. It was started when the American people rose up and said, enough is enough. And what triggered that was when Richard Nixon, the President of the United States, ordered that the special prosecutor investigating him over the Watergate break-in should be fired. And the American people said, no, a president can't pick his own prosecutor. The president can't decide who is going to investigate him and how that investigation is going to take place.
You mentioned firing special prosecutors and not picking who gets to investigate you. Of course, we have a president right now who fired the FBI chief, fired the attorney general, wants to fire the special counsel, we know, tried in the past. We hear a lot about Nixon when we talk about Trump. You, of course, were actually there during the Nixon impeachment crisis on the House Judiciary Committee. How much of a parallel is there, in your view, between Trump's behavior now and Nixon's behavior then?
The parallels are very disturbing, even shocking. You would think that once the country had gone through Watergate, a president would learn the lesson, but apparently not. I mean, we have too many similarities. As you mentioned, the firing of the FBI director who was conducting an investigation into the Trump campaign and its collusion with Russia. The talk about firing Mueller. The attacks on the Mueller investigation. Mm. The firing of Sessions. And most recently, the appointment of someone who is obviously unfit to be attorney general as acting attorney general may even be unconstitutional to appoint him. But Whitaker has already expressed extreme hostility to this investigation.
And you voted yes on the articles of impeachment on the House Judiciary Committee back in the 70s. And then you saw Nixon resign to avoid being impeached. Did you ever think at the time, 4 decades from now, we'll be replaying a lot of this and we won't have learned the lessons from this period?
No, I never thought that. And by the way, there's some other things that are similar. For example, during the impeachment, one of the grounds for the impeachment of Richard Nixon was the dangling of pardons, presidential pardons to the Watergate burglars to hush them up. We've had constant talk about whether presidential pardons were, for example, dangled here in front of various people associated with the investigation.
General Michael Flynn, Paul Manafort, even Michael Cohen at one stage, there was talk of pardoning all these people. You're right there.
Correct.
Do you believe Donald Trump is a bigger crook or could turn out to be a bigger crook than Tricky Dicky Nixon?
We didn't have too much evidence about Nixon's personal finances, although he took a $450,000 deduction for a donation of his papers that was found to be improper. But the committee decided that that action, reprehensible though it was not a ground for impeachment, because the committee had enormously more serious grounds of impeachment that not only affected the president's just action and lawfulness, but first ground for impeachment was his obstruction of justice, in essence, his effort to impede the investigation into the Watergate break-in. Yeah. And he used the whole apparatus of the presidency to try to stop it. But then there were the other things that he did. That was in the second article of impeachment. That had to do with illegal wiretaps that he ordered, the enemies list against political opponents, ordering IRS audits of people who opposed the war. Then you had his acquiescence in, ratification of, the break-in into Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office to find evidence to smear him. And then, of course, you had all the misuse of power that took place in connection with the obstruction of justice. So those were very serious misdeeds.
Very serious. And it's so interesting and so fascinating to hear you speak about them, because obviously you speak about them not just as a historian of that period, but as someone who lived through it, worked through it. You're not just a former congresswoman who was involved in the Nixon impeachment process, but you're also a Harvard law grad. To be clear, you don't believe, do you, that the high crimes and misdemeanors that the Constitution says justifies impeaching and removing a president from office have to necessarily be criminal offenses, do they? They don't have to be criminal offenses.
No, not at all. In fact, as I mentioned before, when we first started the impeachment process on the House Judiciary Committee against Richard Nixon, I don't think many people understood the grounds in the Constitution for impeachment. They are treason, which is defined in the Constitution, bribery, which is a pretty well-understood term, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. The fact of the matter is a high crime and misdemeanor is not an ordinary crime that a normal person can commit. It's a crime that involves the misuse of the powers of office. That's why it's high, because it's committed by a high official.
You say in your new book that, quote, for some, impeachment is something toxic to be avoided at all costs, but you see impeachment, quote, as the grand and solemn tool designed to protect our democracy and to preserve the rule of law. Why do you think it is that so many people do see it as something bad to be avoided at all costs?
Well, I think we've had three presidential impeachment efforts, and two were toxic and wrong. The first, against Andrew Johnson, has been condemned by historians as completely partisan. The one against Bill Clinton, I lived through that, and that was also highly partisan and really a gotcha effort. It never had any public support, and the president never used the powers of his office to engage in the acts, as reprehensible as they were. This was not a threat to the democracy in the way that Richard Nixon's actions were. He used the powers of the presidency, for example, to tell the CIA to stop an FBI investigation. That was a high crime and misdemeanor. You and I couldn't commit that crime. We're not president. We could never tell the CIA to stop an FBI investigation. But a president who did that in order to stop an investigation into his campaign and his aides and himself, that's a high crime and misdemeanor.
And yet, as you say in the book, a lot of people still don't want to, you know, use this tool.
Right. And because they've saw the Clinton impeachment, which they felt was an abuse of power and unwarranted, they don't want to see impeachment again. But what they don't remember, Watergate is very far away in history now, even though I lived through it. What they don't remember is that actually the impeachment effort brought the country together. It didn't divide us. Everybody said when we were started the impeachment effort, oh, impeachment is terrible. It'll never work. It'll be partisan. The country won't support it. It'll tear us apart. All these terrible things. None of those things happened. Richard Nixon was elected in one of the largest landslides in American history, which meant for the public to support the impeachment effort, millions of Americans had to change their mind.
But it was easier to change minds back then. You didn't have this kind of state propaganda channel in the form of Fox News or social media. You had a Republican Party full of semi-reasonable people that were willing to tell Nixon, you got to go, otherwise we'll impeach you. It's hard to imagine a Mitch McConnell or a Chuck Grassley or a Lindsey Graham, the great sycophant in chief these days, saying anything similar to Donald Trump or Trump even listening to them, even if they did.
They may not. But their colleagues might. And if you had overwhelming evidence, as we had during Watergate, and if you spelled out the grounds for impeachment, you would begin to get the kind of public support that allowed the House Judiciary Committee to go forward. Now, we have no confidence in a process. We want to have the result. We want to know that we've got two-thirds of the Senate and a majority in the House of Representatives before we start, even before we set out the case, even before anybody does any research.
Given right now the Democrats don't have a two-thirds majority in the Senate, they don't have any majority in the Senate, and given how partisan politics is and how loyal the Republicans have proved to be to this, you know, almost lawless president in many ways, what is your actual plan? If Nancy Pelosi were to ring you up tomorrow, she says, Elizabeth, I've read your book. What should we do next? What's the plan for me and Chuck Schumer in the Senate?
The real plan in the Senate, I think they've tried to be somewhat bipartisan in at least the Senate Intelligence Committee investigation, but they haven't been thorough. The first thing that has to be done, the work of investigating what President Trump did and how he did it has not been finished. Go back to Watergate. The Senate Watergate hearings had public hearings with public figures. John Dean testified in public. Ehrlichman and Haldeman testified in public. The American people had a chance to see them. The top people here never testified in public. Many of these people refused to answer questions. The committee refused to subpoena documents. The committees refused to do a thorough investigation.
No, there's a lot there, definitely. And I agree with you. They should try and make an effort. I'm completely with you on the opening inquiry. I think the Democrats need to take a much tougher line on impeachment. A couple of things I worry about that I wanted to run past you. The first is the partisan nature of this, the way it will be framed. You, of course, yourself voted in favor of impeaching Nixon. You wrote a book making the case for impeaching George W. Bush, and you've now written this new book, The Case for Impeaching Trump. And yet in 1996, you testified in front of the House Judiciary Committee that Bill Clinton shouldn't be impeached. Do you understand why a lot of Republicans will say, typical Democrats, you just want to use impeachment to get rid of only Republican presidents that you don't like.
Right. I mean, people can always make those charges. I reject them. I'm very concerned about making sure that presidents of the United States obey the law and don't create a kind of new monarchy where they put themselves above the law, commit crimes or commit egregious acts that harm our democracy without accountability.
So the other concern I have is, okay, in the 70s, you got the evidence, you did the process, you got the votes, and Nixon left of his own accord before being impeached. He would have been impeached. You had the votes. You had the public support. My worry is this time, as much as I support impeaching Donald Trump, I do recognize the fact that Donald Trump is not Richard Nixon. And even if you were to get the votes, which is very hard to get, and impeach him and convict him in the Senate, you still have to get him to leave. What if he refuses to leave? What if he says this is a deep state coup? What if his supporters, who we know are kind of cultish, take to the streets? That's a real risk, isn't it, in 2018, 2019, 2020?
Well, everything is a risk, but I think you have to hope that the democratic impulse of Americans and the commitment to democracy is going to work. I mean, in the end, we thought there was a lot of concern that Richard Nixon might stir up a war with Russia. There was a high alert that was called.
And Trump could stir up a war with Iran, or he could just flat out refuse to go. This is a man who said he wouldn't respect the result of the 2016 election if it had gone against him. This is the man who's claiming the recounts in Florida and Georgia are somehow illegitimate.
We'll figure that out if we come to that.
I hope you're right, but I do worry about it. You say in your piece for The Intercept this week that Donald Trump is, quote, a clear and present danger to our democracy, which is something else I completely agree with you on. We've discussed it on the show before. But do you think the leaders of the Democratic Party in Congress, specifically Chuck Schumer in the Senate, Nancy Pelosi probably soon to be Speaker of the House, do they recognize how serious, how almost existential that threat is from Trump? Since last week, since the midterms, they've both been talking up the idea of finding common ground with him, doing deals with him on infrastructure and the rest, and playing down the need for impeachment, which seems mad to me. And I wrote about that for The Intercept on Monday, the idea that they're not taking the threat from him seriously enough. Do you agree?
Look, this is not very different from what happened during Watergate. The House leadership was not in favor of impeachment. They were adamantly opposed to impeachment. Here you had a Senate Watergate committee that had heard from John Dean, had heard from Haldeman and Ehrlichman, had heard from a lot of people involved with the Watergate break-in. The Senate Watergate committee uncovered the tapes, and nobody in the House of Representatives would allow an impeachment process to take place. They didn't want it. And that's when the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate, and we had a Republican president, and they refused to act. Okay, what happened? The American people rose up after the Saturday night massacre and said, Congress, get off your rear end and do something to hold this president accountable. And that's when the effort started. And it was bipartisan from the get-go. The Democrats picked a Republican as their general counsel. The Republicans, of course, picked a Republican as their general counsel. We had two Republicans.
But in the 70s, Elizabeth, that stuff worked. Now you have Jim Comey, lifelong Republican. Robert Mueller, lifelong Republican. Does it endear them to the Republicans at all? This is a Republican party that just doesn't care.
Well, they may not care, but the American people will care. We saw the American people give a pretty resounding rebuff in the midterm elections to Donald Trump. So I don't think that you can just sit here and say, well, it's different now, and no, we don't have the votes in the Senate, and no, you know, that's the exact kind of thing that went on during Watergate, except they never even tried to take the votes in the Senate before they started the process in the House.
Prediction time. Do you think he will be impeached?
I think it depends on the quality of evidence that we can find. I think that that's really key. For example, in Watergate, we were fortunate enough to find a taping system. That came out because of the Senate's careful, thorough, methodical, bipartisan inquiry.
Okay. I'm going to re-ask the question. Do you think it's more likely or less likely that he will be impeached? If you had to just make a bet.
I'm not a betting person. If we sit back and do nothing, it'll never happen. We
Good
have
point.
To reach out
Fair
and
point.
Try, find the facts, find the law, educate the American people, and then trust that they will work and speak out to preserve democracy. If the American people don't want democracy, we're not going to get it, no matter what we do.
On the issue of child separations, quote unquote, I hate using that phrase because it was more like child theft. You wrote about what happened at the border in your book and in your article for The Intercept. You say it's not an impeachable offense, but it reflects on what kind of president the United States has right now.
No, I do think that's an impeachable offense.
Oh, you do?
Yes, I do think that that kind of lawlessness can amount to an impeachable offense. We saw, first of all, there's no law that allowed President Trump to do what he did in terms of ordering the separation. This is an egregious offense, in my opinion, egregious misuse of the power of his office to deprive people of their due process rights. Because if a president could do it to those children, what children are safe?
Elizabeth Holtzman, thank you so much for joining me on Deconstructed.
Thank you.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Underneath my boat, and be it for Bukita, who plays a sour note. W is tired, this despite overwhelming evidence that Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was assassinated at the order of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Trump stood by Saudi Arabia Tuesday in an extraordinary written statement riddled with exclamation points and subtitled America First, writing, quote, "It could very well be that the Crown Prince had knowledge of this tragic event. Maybe he did and maybe he didn't. That being said, we may never know all of the facts surrounding the murder of Mr. Jamal Khashoggi. In any case, our relationship is with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia." Trump's statement came even after the Washington Post reported last Friday that the CIA has high confidence that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the assassination. Despite this, Trump repeated Saudi claims that Khashoggi was an enemy of the state and a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Trump's claims that Saudi Arabia is investing $400 billion in the United States is false. A new report from the Center for International Policy found investment from Riyadh is responsible for fewer than 20,000 U.S. jobs a year and just a fraction of the investment cited by Trump.
Saudi officials have tried to dismiss journalist Jamal Khashoggi's death as a rare, unauthorized killing. But a recent New York Times report suggests the kingdom has sought out private companies to assassinate perceived enemies since the beginning of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's rule. Last week, the Times reported top Saudi intelligence officials close to bin Salman considered a $2 billion plan to hire private intelligence operatives to assassinate prominent Iranians, for example. Well, for more, we go to Tel Aviv, Israel, where we're joined by an Israeli investigative reporter who helped break the story, Ronen Bergman. He has just written an exhaustive new book on the long, secretive history of Israel's extrajudicial killing program. It's titled Rise and Kill First, The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations. Ronen Bergman is a staff writer for The New York Times Magazine and senior national security correspondent for Yedioth Ahronot, Israel's largest daily paid newspaper. His piece in The New York Times is headlined, "Saudis Close to Crown Prince Discussed Killing Other Enemies a Year Before Khashoggi's Death." Ronen Bergman, welcome to Democracy Now! Before we go into the secret history of Israel's targeted assassinations, let's talk about this latest news. Trump standing before reporters and explaining why he will continue to side with Saudi Arabia and the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, despite the CIA saying it's clear that Khashoggi was killed on Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's orders. Can you respond to this and talk about the history of Saudi Arabia and assassination?
Sure. Thank you, Emil and Juan, for inviting me to the show. I think that what Trump just did was the highest level of what the French call realpolitik. He took one interest of the United States, as he sees it, at least, to have these alleged use deal with the Saudi Arabia government and their funding of huge arms deals, and put this as only one consideration and put aside all the rest, human rights, the horrific operation to kill a journalist in their territory, in the consulate, the, I would say, very conclusive evidence suggesting that high Saudi officials, if not the Crown Prince himself, were deeply involved and said, "I just don't care about that." He's not the first one who did that. We saw that many times in world politics before, but it's really done in a very blunt way. We have published last week in the New York Times their case. This is not by one Saudi official, that as early as March 2017, more than a year ago, the Saudis were pitched by a group of Israeli intelligence and American businessmen who asked the Saudis to fund a $2 billion project to cripple Iranian economy. So to create something in a sort of a small Iran-Contra affair, to create a huge private intelligence organization that would use black operations to cripple Iranian economy. While they were discussing this, and on the Saudi side, the manager of these negotiations with General Mohammad Asiri, the chief assistant to Mohammed bin Salman, to MBS, one of the Saudi officials came to the Israelis and Americans and said, "Do you also do kinetics?" They understood him. They said, they knew that kinetics means to kill people. And said, "Who do you want us to kill?" He said, "We want you to take out some Iranian officials." They asked, "Like who?" And he answered, "We want you to take out few Iranians, including Qasem Soleimani, the commander of the Al-Quds Force, the Revolutionary Guard. That's probably the most important Iranian official, the most powerful Iranian intelligence operative. And when the foreigner said no, the people of Saudi intelligence, the official said, well, maybe you can recommend us to someone. And they recommended them a group of a former special operation expert, British one in London, who might do the kinetics. What this proves is that as early as last year, early 2017, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia changed its policy. And instead of diplomacy based mainly on bribe, on money, and staying very much away from secret operation, targeted assassination, they took a much proactive project and considered and pitched even a private businessman. This is, you know, a very unprofessional move to involve people who are not among your own forces in these kind of sensitive operation. They asked them whether they are willing to take the assignment for a lot of money, some of the kingdom's enemies.
Ronan Bergman, I wanted to ask you, in terms of this attempt by the Saudi government to get involved in these kinds of assassinations, is it your sense? I mean, Israel, as you document in your book, has been practicing targeted assassinations now for decades. But I recall back in the 60s or even going back further to the 50s, this was a rare situation. I remember, for instance, the story of a professor from Columbia University, Galindez, who the dictator Trujillo had kidnapped off the streets of New York City, a Columbia University professor, and he was put on a plane to the Dominican Republic and thrown out of the plane. Subsequently, the two assassins who had kidnapped him were themselves killed by Trujillo. But this was considered a rare situation back in the 50s and the 60s. Can you talk about whether your sense is that governments are now increasingly resorting to this kind of assassination to settle their political aims? I'm thinking now, for instance, of the several assassinations we've seen linked to Russian dissidents by the Putin government. Is this becoming an increasing trend across the world?
Well, first, I think we need to differentiate. Israel has been using targeted killing more than any other country in the West post the Second World War. But Israel has defined enemies and defined targets for targeted killings, either proliferators of weapons of mass destruction or terrorists. We are now talking about something very different. This is killing political opponents. And I think maybe someone in Saudi Arabia saw what Putin has been doing in the last few years, which is poisoning, shooting them, and got maybe jealous of what the Russians have been doing, intimidating other rivals and dissidents, and tried to do the same. But in that case, the operation was done in such an unprofessional, so to speak, way, it was very easy to discover. What we see, that technology, the ability of the Turkish intelligence to intercept calls and phone conversations and conversations inside the consulate, the fact that everything is being monitored by cameras, the way that metadata is being achieved, that makes operations for terrorists, but also to state-sponsored assassin much, much harder these days. And here we have the assassination. Turkish intelligence basically cracking open the botched operation to kill Mr. Khashoggi.
At the beginning of your book, you talk about how difficult it was to get access. You say a petition to the Supreme Court for an order forcing compliance with the law that was to get you information was dragged out over years with the complicity of the court, ended with nothing but an amendment to the law itself. The secrecy provisions were extended from 50 to 70 years, longer than the history of the state. Many in Shin Bet and Mossad were warned not to speak to you. How did you get access to this information, and what did you find?
When we exited that court, that petition to Supreme Court that day, one of the chiefs of Israeli intelligence, this was already some years ago, he said, Ronan, don't worry, you will never get hold of these documents, because when the state is 70, we will prolong it to 100 years. And just last week, Benjamin Netanyahu, Israeli prime minister, now the state is 70 years old, prolong it to 90 years. So they are trying to keep these documents away from the public. Fortunately for me, and hopefully the readers of the book, many veterans of Israeli intelligence kept or forgot in their possessions many documents and shared them with me. Why did they speak? Everyone has her or his own reason, but I think that if there's a common ground for why did they speak, most of them on the record, prime minister, minister of defense, chiefs of staff, chiefs of Mossad, to the actual operatives, I think they spoke because they wanted to tell a story. They wanted to tell people of Israel, the people of the world, how and why did they take part in these daring, brave, and controversial operations. They wanted to make sure, after so many years in the dark, they wanted to make sure that their parts in history is being told. Some of them told me, I'm telling you stuff that I didn't tell even my wife. when they spoke, many of them repeated, and they were, of course, completely disconnected from or not synchronized with each other, but they repeated one sentence, one quote from the Babylonian Talmud, which says, if someone comes to kill you, rise up and kill him first. And I think this was said not as an alibi or justification. This was said as to explain a mindset, to explain why have they done things that are considered to be, you know, controversial, if not more than that, because these people, the people that they have killed, are considered to be threat to the sole existence of the nation, a possible risk for a second annihilation. And they wanted these stories to be known, and the reason, and the moral reasons, and also how effective targeted killings are in the course of history.
First of all, your book is mesmerizing. There's so much detail and so well written in terms of the various actions taken by the intelligence forces. Because you go into the early history, even before the establishment of the State of Israel and the clandestine and guerrilla organizations that were part of the liberation movement of the Israelis back in those days. And you say Israeli intelligence from the outset occupied a shadowy realm, one adjacent to yet separate from the country's democratic institutions. The activities of the intelligence community, most of it Shin Bet and the Mossad, under the direct command of the prime minister, took place without any effective supervision by Israel's parliament, the Knesset, or by any other independent external bodies. What damage has been done to the democratic institutions of Israel as a result of this almost parallel situation? Instead of the civilian control, in the military, it was almost as if the military or the intelligence community controlled the government.
Well, few things. First, Israel is a liberal democracy in the Middle East, but Israel also faces severe threats and living under the trauma of the Holocaust. And I think that the new Israelis, the Jews who lived in Palestine, or those who came from the Holocaust and established the State of Israel, they drew three main lessons from the Holocaust. First, there will always be someone who wants to kill them, that the other non-Jews would not do anything to help. And third, is that they need to have Israel, a safe haven, a refuge, and guard it with whatever possible. Now, when you have this at the back of your mind, and every decade your prime nemesis, your chief adversary, Nasser of Egypt, Saddam Hussein of Iraq, Yasser Arafat, Ahmadinejad of Iran, when they want to eliminate you or call for your destruction and take physical actions to do this, then Israelis were left with one conclusion: rise and kill first, paying very little tribute to international law, international norms, and building these two sets of law, one for regular matters and one for the intelligence community and the military. Now, these were under strict orders of the political levels. They were not doing whatever they wanted, but the political level did not use any kinds of, you know, plausible denial. They actually ordered the use of special operations way beyond enemy lines, planting of viruses, sabotage, and at its peak, targeted killing in order to achieve goals. And what are the goals? The goals are to prevent the next war, to try and enlarge the gap between one war to another, if not to prevent the next war, and try to combat the threats to the country without getting into an all-out battle. So kill the enemy at stake instead of going to an all-out war, because Israel cannot stand these wars forever. You ask about the damage. Of course, a democracy that adopts two sets of law, one for regular overt set of law and one secret for the intelligence community. This is a problem. This is a highly legalized and moralized problem. And it led to clashes between these two sets of law. The people of Israeli intelligence would say, yes, we knew that we are cleaning the sewage. And everybody in Israel also figured out what we are doing in order to clean the sewage, meaning dealing with our enemies. But there was no other way to go.
Talk about the attempts to assassinate Yasser Arafat and how far back they went.
Yes, it dates back to 1968, shortly after Arafat was appointed not just the chief of Fatah, but the chief of the umbrella organization called the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. The IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, were desperate. Arafat and the PLO were sending groups of terrorists from Jordan to Israel. They couldn't catch them. They couldn't catch him. An attempt to invade Jordan and kill them end up in a catastrophe. And then the chief psychiatrist of the Israeli Navy came with what he said is a solution. He saw that movie, American movie, The Manchurian Candidate, and said, I can do the same. I can take a Palestinian, hypnotize him, Jason Bourne style, program him, and send him to Jordan to kill Yasser Arafat. And believe it or not, the chiefs of Israeli intelligence, military intelligence, and Mossad took that very seriously. They gave him a Palestinian prisoner who fit the profile that the psychiatrist thought would be suitable for such a process. They gave him a training facility with live ammunition, and for months he trained that person until one night he said, okay, he's done, he's fully programmed. That Palestinian crossed the Jordan River, and after crossing, he signaled a gun and okay to his master, the psychiatrist, and he carried the gun and a wireless communication device, and the psychiatrist said he is now going to kill Arafat. This was something like 1 a.m. At 5 a.m. in the morning, the operatives of Israeli intelligence received a report from another agent, said that someone, a Palestinian, came to a Jordanian police station and told the policeman, the stupid Israelis thought that they hypnotized me, but I was just playing a role. I'm loyal to Arafat. Please take me to Abu Ammar, to Yasser Arafat, to swear allegiance to the Palestinian Authority. Now, this is a bit, you know, sometimes Israeli James Bond looks more like Inspector Clouseau. This is a bit of a funny story, but the other stories were less funny.
There are, of course, many questions about Arafat's final death, whether it was natural or not.
Let me just add that they tried many times, and the peak of that was in 1982, when Ariel Sharon, Israeli Minister of Defense at that time, ordered to take down a commercial airline with hundreds of passengers on board in order to kill Yasser Arafat. But the chiefs of Israeli Air Force rebelled against him. They didn't want Israel to be stained in this horrific war crimes, and they didn't want to violate the ethics of the IDF, and they prevented the operations from happening. To your question, there is an ambiguity and a few different reports about that. Let me just tell you that a few months before Arafat's demise, Israel Prime Minister Ariel Sharon met with President Bush at the White House, and the president told him, Mr. Prime Minister, we heard that you have plans to kill Yasser Arafat, and we want you to promise me that you will not assassinate Arafat. And Ariel Sharon said, I see your point, Mr. President. Now, President, of course, understand this is not a promise, said, I really want you to promise me that you will not do that. To which Sharon said, Mr. President, you are making a very strong argument. But the president didn't let it go until Prime Minister Sharon promised in his voice that he will not kill Arafat. A few months later, Arafat dies of a mysterious disease. And I think in time, we will have the opportunity to tell the story behind that. In the meantime, Palestinians are convinced, of course, that the Mossad or Israeli intelligence killed him.
And what about you, Ronan? What do you think?
I think that in time, we will be able to tell the real story behind that. But I think that if Israel done that, the reason to hide the real story was not because of the Palestinians, but because this would be a striking violation to a very clear promise by Israeli Prime Minister to an American president.
You also talk about, we only have a minute left, but how George W. Bush adopted Israeli tactics. And then you say that President Obama would launch several hundred targeted assassinations.
After September 11, Prime Minister Sharon ordered all Israeli intelligence to open their door to perform what was later called a striptease in front of American intelligence and show them everything they have on intelligence collection and targeted killing, because he thought this would be the right way, the right move from the American armed forces and intelligence community to go for the global war on terror. Much that was done by the United States in the years after is based on Israeli experience, know-how, and technology. I am saying that the U.S., while adopting these tactics, also needs to see the moral lesson, the moral price that Israel has paid. When you kill someone, even if that someone is Satan himself, I believe that something is dying in you. And when you have practically thousands of people, because of technology, because of guided munition, because of cybers, actually thousands of people in Israel have participated directly or indirectly in targeted killing operations, this is a problem. And the most important, I think, is that some of Israeli leaders drew the wrong conclusion from the really remarkable successes of their intelligence services. And they thought that they can use these exotic capabilities to go for pinpoint operation way beyond enemy lines to kill people in order to solve every problem, not just tactical threats to your citizens, but also political problems, also historical problems, to hold history by its tail. And therefore, I think that the story of Rise and Kill First, after 8 years of research, and as you said, 1,000 interviews, if there's a lesson, is that these operations have tactical meanings. They save lives. They are effective. But this is a story of a tactical success, but also of a very, very dangerous strategic political failure. Because once you think that using force can solve everything, then you don't need to turn into statesmanship, into diplomacy, into a real discourse with your adversary.
You talk about killing the devil himself. What about when you're killing innocent civilians?
The price paid for killing civilians for collateral damage is horrendous. But when you come to these operatives and speak with them and they tell you, look, we were facing situations, and the book consists of many of these really dramatic moments, when you know you have a window of opportunity to kill a Hamas jihadist organization who have already sent suicide bombers that already killed hundreds of Jews and Israelis, and you have a very short window of opportunity to kill him before he sends more suicide bombers, and he's walking only among civilians, he's walking in populated areas, he's walking with his wife, then the operatives, when I ask them, why did you permit collateral damage? They ask me back. So what would you do? If you do not kill him, you know that many of your own people will be killed tomorrow. What do you do?
She asked if I had anything further to say, and now, a few years later, the answer is yes. This is happening right now. The Church of the Subgenius, as orchestrated by the Subgenius Foundation and visible at subgenius.com, is an ongoing concern. There was a good party going on in 1915 at the Cabaret Voltaire in Zurich, but you didn't go. The fun moved to Paris in 1920, you dilly-dallied around until it was over. Paris hosted a fine situation in 1957, but you let it drift away. You could have stayed right where you are now and had an experience with the hippies in the 60s, but you sat it out, just like you sat out the punks of the 1970s. Tell yourself you weren't born yet or were just an infant, if that makes you feel better. The point is, this is happening right now. The Church of the Subgenius, as orchestrated by the Subgenius Foundation and visible at subgenius.com, is an ongoing concern. And by consternation, you had best not be the last mutant on the bust. The Church of the Subgenius is something that you can take or leave a DNA sample of. Some invisible monster that lives in the sky saw fit to give you a unique thumbprint, and now you have a blackberry pie you can stick it in. You can go to a Subgenius event. You can put one on yourself. You can meet or avoid every Subgenius walking this planet. You might come up with the next good joke that you hear some other Subgenius tell you back someday. Or you might be a frog watcher off to the side, but a frog watcher that showed up nonetheless. When you see the saucers leave this planet, and that one Subgenius you were too shy to talk to or punch in the snout has their face mashed up against the window and is giving you the bird, will you be saying, "Gosh, I blew it again"? Or will you be that Subgenius? Why not both?
I'm looking up again. I'm
wearing his
thing called love. I'm not quite sure as to what is going down.
And it feels so good.
You are risking your life.
It was only later that I knew he'd murdered almost a million people.
Know what I'm saying? Show enough. Yo, it's a wonderful world, and yeah, I'm living.
What can I say? I'm a liberated male. I may have something for you.
What is going on here?
I'm on my grind, baby, because I want the life, the golden child. I want the knife.
And I think that that's the part of the song that really tells all.
I just might stop to
excuse me, which do you think would be the more exciting, the more sadomasochistic?
Look, I know it is a strange request, but I need to get up that mountain of the equipment. There's valuable information up there.
With all due respect, sir, Dr. Oscar Valian is the leading authority on
the stuff that stops your heart.
Blurting obscenities out.
I think you got some rats.
Hey, yo, we stay honest. Won't make a fake promise. Pay homage to truth and never stray from it.
I'm inside my lab stabbing rounds on black papyrus.
I'm trying to chill, though, even though situation looking kind of ill, yo. It came to me like a song I wrote.
I'm very susceptible to peer pressure.
You've been so good today that now we're going to watch a cartoon.
I'll be your guide on this trip through reality. And on this trip, I can make you see anything I want you to see. I am your eyes and through the movies. Right now, we're looking in a mirror. Now watch this. See what I can do? Now watch this. I can show you everything. You have no choice. You may even see things you can't stand to see. Or I may show you lies, which you will call truth. So remember, this is not your story. And you aren't in it. I am telling it to you.
Hit the mic like it's stress weed. I spit the spike, don't test me.
Don't test.
Impress fiends when I bust out the next thing. Goal is to roll. Finger shift like I'm texting. Linger and lift, chug another fifth. Falling cannabis abyss, what bliss. No more indifference if you hit this. Makes me miss ignorance, reminisce on tolerance. But true relief is to holler riffs. Little sis said flow, tired of this. Still I blow, hot as shit. Exhale rap to keep my lungs slick. Like whoa, that pale chap just sung Rick. I'm like laddie daddy, here to fuck up the party. Armed with Bacardi, they didn't even card me. Broken, empty, but smartly sharp free. Don't let me start heat, cause it darts to the heart when I spark a beat. I'm the pusher turned shover, homie shout truth that. Kick a freestyle, did you know we could do that? Bitch, I bring back the boom back and put the city of Jerusalem on the map. Spit smoke, spit rhythm, spit fire and indecision. Spit spiteful inhibition, spit phlegm when they say pay tuition. I spit like it's a fucking addiction and pen's the drug you're picking. Spit out medication, get a dose of dedication. No vacation, I can't relax. Spit with 2 feet on the gas. Leave the soul in the booth, try to spit truth for the youth. Like friends come and go, but fiends will never let you go. Call me up just to holler, yo. Slachli achi, you're dashing yet a sachi. Oh, thanks for asking. And yourself? I guess I need you to entertain me. Cause lately I've been stir crazy. Bumping juicy till I get loopy with disordered fantasies. Plus music all I got since I aborted Hennessy. Caught menacing, saying school is where you better be. My temper heats cause I've never been stung by a debtor bee. Shit, I guess it's rest in peace. To the peace for me. Pusher turned shover, homie shout truth that. Kick a freestyle, did you know we could do that? Bitch, I'll bring back the boom back and put the city of Jerusalem on the map. I'm the pusher turned shover, homie shout truth that. Kick a freestyle, did you know we could do that? Bitch, I'll bring back the boom back and put the city of Jerusalem on the map. I'm the pusher turned shover, homie shout truth that. Kick a freestyle, did you know we could do that? Bitch, I bring back the boom back and put the city of Jerusalem on the map.
Bob. 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 Bob.
It takes more than intellect to be a musician.
The machine gave me my penny back.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, okay. Oh, okay. I've got a rant here. It's not by me. It's by Onan. Dr. Onan Cantobite. Remembered. Today, he says, I remembered. I don't have to keep up with current events that I cannot influence in any way, much less resolve. Phew! It's nice to put down and walk away from all that anxiety and anger. I've got enough self-generated anxiety and anger. I don't need anybody else's. And I sure don't need the conspiracy's anxiety and anger. All kinds of bad things and sad things are happening in the world. And even right down the street. And there's not a thing I can do about them. Nothing. Not even stay informed or quote-unquote spread awareness. And those things I can do something about, well, I am doing them and usually not telling anybody. The telling anybody part, that's not worked out so well. Hey, I'm doing this good thing. Yeah, but it's not that other good thing or enough of that good thing itself. You don't have to remember what I remembered today, but you do have to remember. Remember you're a sub-genius. Remember this planet is Mars. Remember, you are not just different, but better than most people. Remember to send $1. Remember that last one often. Remember the people who got you down that one time, they're suffering too. Not so you can forgive them, but so you can gloat and bask in your effort-free revenge. Remember, you will die, and not too long from now. Remember that Bob has probably forgotten you already, but some important, funny, old-time sub-genie think your thing was pretty great, and they want you to have slack. Do you demand proof? Then know that the anagram for sub-genius remember is Gibber Sneer Museum. And those were the words of Reverend Dr. Uncle Onan Canobite. And now this.
When you're driving 16 hours, think of Bob. When you use your mutant powers, think of Bob. When your blood is low in sugar, when you're picking out a bugger, when you shoot him with a Luger, think of Bob. When you're outside exercising, think of Bob. When you're using sex devices, think of Bob. When you're walking through the woods, when you make out with the goods, when you beat up to the hoods, think of Bob. Away. We'll take it too.
That big bad Bob, heaven in the sky. That's right, just send us your $1. You get a lot more for your money. Heck, $1, you get Bob. Think of Bob, yeah, think of Bob. We're all thinking about Bob. Yeah, he makes us think of Bob. Everybody's thinking about Bob. Everybody wants to think of Bob. Yeah, we're all thinking about Bob. We're thinking about Bob. Yeah, we're thinking about Bob. Everybody's thinking about Bob.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
The New York Times recently published a major expose of the inner workings of the social media company Facebook over the past several years. The investigative piece revealed that Facebook executives Sheryl Sandberg and founder Mark Zuckerberg made major missteps in the years after the 2016 election revealed that its user data had been misused. According to the Times, bent on growth, the pair ignored warning signs and then sought to conceal them from public view. At critical moments over the last 3 years, they were distracted by personal projects and passed off security and policy decisions to subordinates, according to current and former executives. Even worse, the Times found that Facebook employed a Republican opposition research firm to discredit activist protesters, in part by linking them to the liberal financier George Soros. The report was based on interviews with more than 50 people. Groups like Color of Change, which were among those targeted, denounced the social media platform's actions as reprehensible and dangerous and said that Facebook, quote, should be ashamed. My guest is Ramesh Srinivasan, director of the Digital Cultures Lab and associate professor of Information Studies and Design and Media Arts at the University of California, Los Angeles. This interest interesting piece by the New York Times has come after Facebook has been in the crosshairs of politicians and lawmakers. Zuckerberg famously testified in front of Congress and had to defend the way in which his outlet has been used, and, you know, he has allowed it to be used in our political sphere. Were you surprised that Facebook, run by Jewish Americans, would hire a PR firm that essentially used an anti-Semitic tactic to discredit its critics?
I think what we have here are a bunch of sort of competing motivations. And at the end of the day, the choices that Sheryl Sandberg and Mark Zuckerberg have made are very clear. They are focused on Facebook's bottom line, and they're focused on ensuring that Facebook maintains its now 2.2 billion person user base. And so if you notice in the past, statements have been made supporting maintaining Holocaust denier content on Facebook. And those are choices that were made explicitly by Mark Zuckerberg under sort of freedom of speech types of justifications. So, you know, despite their own personal identity as Jewish people, it's quite clear that as business leaders, Facebook is making choices that are focused, again, on the technology maintaining its centrality in all of our lives. And it's a very convenient and very popular, sadly, excuse that's used these days to blame almost anything that is problematic on people of color, on minorities, and on Jewish people. You know, we see that happening with the sort of redirecting of blame at the hands of George Soros and other folks like that, you know, who are targets of hatred, targets of mail bombs, literally, by the fringe on the right in this country and in this world. And now we're at a moment that is pretty unprecedented in recent decades where the fringe right, the racist right, is now emboldened to have a great amount of voice and political power, partly thanks to the presidency.
Right. This tactic by this PR firm, it's called Definers Public Affairs, and it was actually founded by Republican operatives. This particular institution essentially helped push a narrative that those organizations critiquing Facebook were being bankrolled by Soros and his Open Society foundations. This is exactly the approach that Donald Trump and Donald Trump supporters have taken to discredit the left. In fact, Trump, in the wake of the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings and the protests around it, basically said that these protesters were paid for by Soros. And Facebook, in hiring this company, is essentially using the same tactics as Trump and his racist supporters. They should have known this was going to come out eventually.
Maybe they should have, but it's quite clear that their interests are completely focused on keeping everybody happy with them, and they will go to almost any moral or ethical lengths, it seems, to maintain that. So we see them coddling their longtime friend, Senator Chuck Schumer, the minority leader in the United States Senate, on the one hand, you know, to sort of maintain mainstream kind of liberal credibility or mainstream democratic credibility. I wouldn't even say liberal. But at the same time, we see them playing two populist right-wing sort of lines that frame everything as a Jewish conspiracy, frame it as a conspiracy of, you know, migrants and pseudo-caravans that are invading our country. So we have to get back to the real core issue here, which is the platform, and we can speak about how that occurred, but the platform upon which so-called fake news proliferated and became the norm and became the information that really informed people in the United States and around the world about political content is perfect for the company to put fake news onto themselves, right? So there is no better company for popularizing fake news themselves than the company on whose platform fake news proliferated, right? There's something very sad but true about this situation, and it speaks to the amorality, not the immorality inherently, but the amorality, the absence of a clear ethical compass outside of maintaining credibility and therefore users. You know, 2.2 billion users we're talking about around the world.
Well, you say amorality, but it almost seems, at least to those of us on the left, that Facebook is tilted toward the right. Not when it comes to relationships with politicians like Chuck Schumer, but when it comes to whose content is allowed to remain on Facebook. You mentioned that Facebook has essentially allowed anti-Semitic content under the guise of protecting free speech, and yet activists that are with groups affiliated with Black Lives Matter have found that Facebook has routinely willingly censored their pages whenever they post stuff that's critical of police. It can tend to, at least anecdotal evidence points, that Facebook will remove it, saying that it's violated the community guidelines. Right. And that's one of the ways in which Color of Change, the organization I mentioned earlier, had gotten involved with Facebook, because the live stream of the young Black mother in Washington State, Corinne Gaines, was removed from Facebook, her account shut down by Facebook at the request of police who essentially surrounded her home and then killed her. And Facebook was taken to task by groups like Color of Change. And yet Zuckerberg put up a banner saying Black Lives Matter on the Facebook campus. Where do you think all of these stories show Facebook's position is on the equality of Black people in America?
I really hear what you're saying, and I completely agree that it's not just amorality. It's whatever it takes to maintain profit for Facebook. So in terms of public perception, Facebook would never want to be, as it now has been exposed, aligned with anti-Black interests, anti-civil rights interests, anti-Black Lives Matter interests. However, it also does not want to be aligned with, honestly, xenophobic and racist interests, insofar as those interests translate to any sort of threat to their user base. And I want to get at why, in my mind, at least a theory I have on why it is that these sort of fringe right-wing stories are so welcome on Facebook. And we're finding not just welcome in terms of how the technology operates, but welcome in terms of being explicitly solicited by the company itself, in terms of who they hire. And the reason why is there's a great amount of sensational, attention-grabbing, jaw-dropping, hysteria-inducing, spectacle-based content that is produced out of the fringe of the right that is now sort of the new normal in our political discourse in this country. And that works for Facebook. Why is that? It gets our attention, just like Trump gets our attention, right? It gets our attention. If our attention is grabbed, Facebook has exactly what it wants, because the more attention it gets, the more data it gets, the more it can persuade us and take us down all sorts of dysfunctional yet addictive rabbit holes.
Interestingly enough, at this very time that you and I are talking, a story of the police killing of the brother of a Facebook executive in Northern California has been in the news. The killing actually took place a while ago. Chinedu Okobi, the brother of Facebook executive Ebele Okobi, was brutally murdered by police, and she just got the chance to review the footage, the police footage of his killing, and what she described sounds like a straightforward police execution by multiple police officers. Horrible, horrible story. And she's speaking out. She wants justice for her brother. And one wonders if groups like Black Lives Matter or other activists were to post or repost Ebele Okobi's justifiably angry post about her brother's police killing, whether Facebook would find that that violated community standards.
Right. Facebook wants to shy away from controversy if that controversy doesn't grab your attention. And this could grab their attention, but it's very important, it seems, right? As we're finding out, every day we're finding out a little bit more from this bombshell that broke through the New York Times, that Facebook is very, very interested in maintaining its centrality in the lives of right-wing and white users in this country. And it gives me the sense that, you know, when you look at the world and you look at who has power in the world institutionally, politically, and so on, you see Facebook taking sides with the powerful. And, you know, that's not just something that we see in the United States. That's something we saw in Myanmar with Facebook banning multiple Rohingya, right? The Muslim minority. They were banning Facebook groups that were pro-Rohingya, even created by Rohingya people themselves, while they were endorsing Facebook groups that were created by the Burmese military that was enacting a genocide. We see the same thing happening in the Philippines with Rodrigo Duterte and his so-called cyber troop foot soldiers. We see the same thing happening on WhatsApp, which is a platform that Facebook owns. Remember, Facebook owns WhatsApp, owns Instagram, with Narendra Modi in India, with Bolsonaro in Brazil. The pattern is again and again. Right-wing hateful interests are welcome as long as they accomplish the output for which Facebook as a company and therefore its technological design are optimized, which is keeping you into the hysteria zone, keeping you into the shock and awe zone. The effects of this are politically, and I would say on a deeper level, ethically and on a spiritual level, disastrous. They're disastrous on us because they keep us in hysterical silos. They misinform us and literally, at times, intentionally disinform us. And that's what we see happening here with Facebook. They want to play to all sides, and in so doing, they ultimately play to their side, which is how do we keep you glued to dysfunctional content?
Facebook is going to be spending a lot of money in the UK to train journalists. This is a really interesting piece that essentially shows that Facebook thinks that it needs to train journalists. When I saw this story, I thought to myself, isn't it journalists that should be training Facebook?
Thank you. That's exactly what I was going to say. Thank you. Again, Facebook wants to be the platform for everything we do. Our experiences of the social world, inclusive of news and political information. They want to be the public space, but they're not publicly accountable. So that includes encapsulating and basically capturing all journalistic content. You know, when I interviewed Noam Chomsky for my new book, and I talked to him about manufacturing consent, right? This 30-year-old critique of how news stories are sourced to reflect the interests of the powerful. Chomsky made the point, those interests have not changed, but at least these folks are journalists, meaning that they have some attempt. They're not just pundits and analysts, so-called analysts like Sean Hannity, just talkers. They're actually trying to gather information and present some sort of logical, rational form toward things. What Facebook does is it takes the already closed ecosystem of journalistic content that you get even on the New York Times, and it winnows it down even further. It silos it further. And the reason why it silos is it keeps your attention. By keeping your attention, it can actually expose you to an even narrower window into news information that's out there. So I think a lot of these sorts of moves, like hiring local journalists, are PR moves. I think that they also are seen as a low risk investment and low cost investment that can allow Facebook to be seen as the local town crier as well, the local zine, right? And what you have to note, whenever you see big tech companies, and this is something I'm making the point in my new book, including Google, you know, setting up AI labs, artificial intelligence labs, multiple labs on the continent of Africa, is their goal is to present the world to you always on their platform. And remember, and this is an important point that was not stated very visibly with this latest New York Times story, people who have never created an account with Facebook ever before, right? Say you and I never created an account. We never had any interest in Ali. It's not like we once created an account and we got off the platform. You never created an account. You are still being tracked by Facebook. And those are called registered non-users. In what sense are you registered if you've never created an account? Are you registered to surveillance? That's what you're registered to.
How do they even find people who haven't used Facebook? I mean, just from any other internet use? They're buying data from Google or something?
Tracking analytics software is on almost all of our web browsers, and it's on our mobile phones, more importantly. So even if you don't have the app installed, there is tracking software that's connected to other sorts of platforms, might even be somehow connected to the iOS. There's a real lack of clarity and transparency and disclosure around those issues.
And of course, Facebook's goal, I imagine, is to ultimately convert all those non-users into users.
And you're something of a user, even if you're being tracked, you're still providing data that provides value to this private interest. Remember, private company masquerading as public space. So wants to benefit from public engagement, but doesn't want to be publicly accountable, right? So there's this kind of very interesting bait and switch in terms of framing and branding that I think is a big part of this as well. I can't emphasize it enough. You also have to look at what we call the political economy of these companies. Who do they own? How, you know, sort of vertically integrated are those organizations? And so again, if you have Instagram, if you have WhatsApp, you have, you know, other like goggles and wearables. The question is if you look at the overall portfolio of ownership for Facebook as a company, much as you might do the same for Alphabet, which is like the Google holding company, you can see something far more ubiquitous, you know, it's essentially an enclosure on your life, right? And a digital enclosure.
One of the big reasons why Facebook has been making news for how it functions is, of course, the 2016 presidential election that I mentioned, we just had a major election, the midterm elections, and going into those midterm elections, there were a lot of concern that Facebook would essentially allow itself to be used or misused ahead of that election, like it did ahead of the presidential election, when the Cambridge Analytica, the British PR firm, essentially used Facebook to micro-target voters. As far as you know, how did Facebook do this election?
The way Facebook is set up as an architecture whereby third parties can gather data from Facebook installed applications. So, you know, we all heard about the Cambridge Analytica saga, which I actually had contact with Cambridge Analytica before the story broke, because I was trying to just kind of describe what they were all about before. Mm-hmm. It's very important to know that Cambridge Analytica worked all over the world with many different governments, dozens, in fact, not just right-leaning, but also left-leaning at times, or even centrist in various parts of the world. They also worked for the Ted Cruz campaign before they worked for Trump. In fact, they worked for the Ted Cruz campaign for a much longer period of time. How do organizations like this that are interested in micro-targeting users with psychologically influential content, how do they function? Well, the key is they gather data on their users on Facebook itself. How do they do that? Well, they have little games. There are little games you can play, like Candy Crush Saga. In this case, it was called My Personality Quiz. And what we all did was decide to play that game and post that information and laugh about it with our friends on Facebook. I don't think either you or I did it, Sonali, but I'm not sure. And what that quiz in this particular case was actually created by a man named Alexander Kogan, who worked with Cambridge Analytica and provided the data of the users who used that quiz. But the key point is that's not enough to get that much data. They also got the data of all of the friends of those users who played that game. And so this is all seen as a feature of Facebook's platform. Remember, what we see politically or publicly or socially as flaws or threats to social welfare or democracy or cohesion and tolerance and love are actually features of the platform. The platform is set up to allow for micro-targeting. And the key secret sauce, if you will, about Cambridge Analytica, though it's not been proven that they really had a major influence on the election outcome, but the key feature was they were able to map data that they gathered through Facebook, one. Two is they purchased a great amount of data. Hundreds of millions of Americans can have their data purchased about them through their credit card records, through other sorts of records as well. We are leaking data everywhere we go, thanks to these mobile phones, through what are called digital footprints. And they're bringing those data streams together, the Facebook data and the digital footprints, and comparing them to fine-tuned psychological models, what they call psychometric models of people. So it's not like Ramesh is 40 years old and Indian American and lives in this part of Los Angeles. It's that Ramesh is neurotic in these ways in relation to these people at these times of the day, open in these ways, agreeable in these other ways. These are fine-tuned models that are linking psychological identities, of which we have many, with all these digital footprints that are brought together. So, you know, who I present myself as on Facebook, or maybe you also, card, right? Those are different forms of my identity. But if you can bring all those different trails together, you can really, really target and manipulate people. And you can even influence them to not vote, which is what we see some evidence of related to Hillary Clinton supporters dating back to 2016, with targeted super predator type content reaching black voters.
Bye. muletita.
Kamba puchi comercio, mana shita chishachu. Kamba cuadra comercio, mana shita chishachu. Kamba puchi comercio, mana shita chishachu.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
President Trump, the most racist president we've had since we decided presidents probably shouldn't be racist. Trump had a week of responding to things in a non-ideal manner, from calling Saudi Arabia a spectacular ally just a day after the CIA implicated Mohammed bin Salman in a journalist killing, to touring the devastation following the California wildfires and having this exchange.
Does seeing this devastation, though, change your opinion at all on climate change, Mr. President?
No, no. I have a strong opinion. I want great climate. We're going to have to have...
I want great climate. At this point, Trump just inserts whatever noun someone just said into his stock bullshit answers. What's your opinion on SpongeBob SquarePants, Mr. President? I want great SpongeBob, and we're going to have that. It's going to be the spongiest Bob, and we love it, don't we? The pants that are square, we love them. Clearly was deeply affected by what happened in Paradise, California, whose residential areas were nearly 90% destroyed. And what he saw there in Paradise, California, is clearly something he will never forget.
You don't see what's going on until you come here. And what we saw at Pleasure, what a name right now. But when, what we just saw, we just left Pleasure.
Paradise.
For Paradise.
Pleasure, paradise, it's easy to get them mixed up. Just remember, Mr. President, pleasure is the dancer, paradise is where she works.
We'll be right back.
Trump also refused to acknowledge that climate change might be causing these fires.
Does seeing this devastation, though, change your opinion at all on climate change, Mr. President?
No, no. I have a strong opinion. I want great climate.
You want learned grammar. I want new president.
Biggest unforced error this week was during a Medal of Freedom ceremony where, in honoring the late Antonin Scalia, he abandoned the prepared text at one point. See if you can spot where.
Joining us for this ceremony is his wife, Maureen, who's become a great friend of my family, myself, and their 9 children, Anne, Jean, John, Catherine, Mary Claire, Paul, Matthew, Christopher and Meg. You were very busy. Wow. Wow. I always knew I liked him.
What she did with her emails is so criminal, is so dishonest, is so shocking.
She was willing to risk our foreign enemies reading her emails. She lied like a dog on her emails. She lied like a dog.
So, tough words for his own daughter. I assume he'll do an interview sometime this month claiming he never met Ivanka, but heard she's nice.
President Trump's own daughter and senior advisor, Ivanka, is under fire for her use of private email to send official emails. And this, by the way, is from November 2nd. It's not even today's headline. This headline's from more than a year ago. Here's this week's headline. The Washington Post revealing that Ms. Trump used a private email address for hundreds of official emails last year. Now, this revelation comes after ethics watchdog group American Oversight sent a Freedom of Information Act request. The group wrote to the heads of both congressional oversight committees saying the American public insists that all public officials, including the president's daughter, comply with federal law. But Ivanka is not the only Trump administration official to use a private email address. At least 5 others, including her husband, Jared Kushner, who's also a senior advisor to the president, former chief of staff Reince Priebus, former chief strategist Steve Bannon, former economic advisor Gary Cohn, and current immigration hawk and advisor Stephen Miller. The president himself reportedly refuses to give up his personal iPhone, despite warnings that his calls are not secure.
Hey, Tazzy, old devil. You sure toss a mean salad.
President Trump has been spinning in a Tasmanian devil-style rage this week as rumors of turmoil and tumult continue to swirl. Trump took to Twitter to lash out at special counsel Robert Mueller. At 7:14 a.m., the president packed, "The inner workings of the Mueller investigation are a total mess. They have found no collusion and have gone absolutely nuts. They are screaming and shouting at people, horribly threatening them to come up with the answers they want. They are a disgrace to our nation and don't... ..."
And then he left us hanging for 18 minutes before delivering part two. Care how many lives they ruin. These are angry people, including the highly conflicted Bob Mueller, who worked for Obama for 8 years. They won't even look at all of the bad acts and crimes on the other side. A total witch hunt like no other in American history. He always forgets we had real witch hunts in American history, in which they killed witches, but this is the biggest witch hunt, and Bob Mueller is moving on you like a witch.
I guarantee you one thing. We're going to be talking about those emails every moment of every day.
Sometimes the jokes write themselves.
Mr. President, thank you for sitting down with me.
I think I'm doing a great job.
Well, you are sitting down, so yes. In that respect, you've nailed it. Now, you just appointed Matthew Whitaker as your acting attorney general.
He's a very smart person.
That is debatable. Because he was on the board of a company which believes that Sasquatch is real. Do you believe Sasquatch exists?
It's true, 100%.
So would you appoint Bigfoot to your cabinet? Maybe have him replace John Kelly as your chief of staff?
Probably.
You know he's a mythical ape creature, right?
Let's see what happens. Look, I have 3 or 4 or 5 positions that I'm thinking about. Of that, maybe it's going to end up being 2, maybe. But I need flexibility.
Trump's also getting criticized for his latest hire, Acting Attorney General Matt Whitaker. We're learning some interesting stuff about Whitaker's past. For instance, his 2014 run for the GOP Senate nomination in Iowa. Now, he lost, but while campaigning, here's what he said was criteria for his judges.
I'd like to see things like their worldview, what informs them, how have they lived their lives? Are they people of faith? Do they have a biblical view of justice, which I think is very important because we all know that our government...
Levitical or New Testament?
I'm a New Testament. and what I know is as long as they have that worldview, that they'll be a good judge.
In the opinion of the present Attorney General of the United States, if you're not a Christian, you won't be a good judge. But it's right there in the Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of a religion, yada, yada, yada. What would Jesus do? Now, I want to warn our viewers that have allergies that this next headline is nuts. Because today, we learned that the acting Attorney General of these United States, Matthew Whitaker, is steeped in time travel and Bigfoot. Now, before we go any further, I just want to say that there's serious debate over whether Whitaker's appointment is unconstitutional and might obstruct justice. But tonight, Daddy don't give a damn. I want to talk about time traveling Bigfoot, man. Because here's the deal. Whitaker... This is true. Whitaker was a paid advisor and hot tub pitchman for a company called World Patent Marketing. Well, in 2013, Whitaker's company claimed to have DNA evidence proving that Bigfoot exists. He was on the paid advisory board of this company that was so all in on Bigfoot, they had a website selling Bigfoot paraphernalia and planned a celebrity event called You Have Been Squatched. But Whitaker wasn't just working for Bigfoot hucksters. They were also selling a time machine, which they said could be possible perhaps within the next decade, suggesting users might relive moments from your past or visit your future. Whitaker's company was shut down for defrauding investors out of $26 million. So, this has all been fun, right? Bigfoot, time travel, fraud. You can't ask for more. And yet, the Matt Whitaker giveth. Because I invite you now to join me in viewing the best product the new Attorney General of the United States ever helped sell the world, the extra deep masculine toilet for the well-endowed. The idea behind this actual patent application, supported by, again, the Attorney General of the United States, is that well-endowed men would dip a, let's say, toe in the water of a regular toilet. And here's the actual patent application drawing showing that on the manly throne, the distance between the rim and the water is at least 12 inches. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, hey, this is great news for my penis. But does the Attorney General of the United States, Matt Whitaker, have anything for my testicles? Don't worry, World Patent Marketing also had a product called Snowballs, cooling underwear designed to maximize fertility by lowering the temperature of your testicles and help you optimize the production of natural testosterone.
Every day we learn more about the man personally installed by President Trump 2 weeks ago on constitutionally dubious grounds to run the Justice Department. And every day, the details that we are learning about Matthew Whitaker are more troubling, indeed, more obviously disqualifying. Here's the latest. After 2 weeks in which the Justice Department refused to hand over Whitaker's standard ethics financial disclosure, it was finally released late yesterday, and it appears it has been revised at least 5 times. One can only imagine what exactly was going on with those documents during those 2 weeks. And it's not a crazy question, given what we've also learned about a strange financial chapter in Whitaker's career, when he headed up a dark money nonprofit group that reported Whitaker as the sole employee, where he made $400,000 a year over 3 years. The salary came from a group called FACT, whose donor or donors, we do not know, are shrouded in secrecy. And while FACT claimed to be a new nonpartisan watchdog nonprofit, you can get an idea from Whitaker's TV appearances in his capacity as its leader what it was up to.
Let's all be honest here. You know, sort of, she had a server that she controlled. They reviewed all the emails now, I heard over the weekend. So what we'd really like to see is all of the emails.
We've got a pending FOIA request with the State Department regarding his emails and his interactions with the Clinton Foundation.
It sure looks like a nonprofit created to launder right-wing attacks through the name of a putatively independent new org. Now, this comes on top of the fact that his other recent activities included being a paid advisory board member of a patent company which allegedly scammed $26 million from its customers and is now being criminally investigated by the FBI. Of course, housed in the same Justice Department he now oversees.
Slip sliding away, slip sliding away.
The noose of Mr. Whitaker around their neck, so to speak, in that the president has sort of had a check. It's not a checkmate, but he's made a chess move on the board that puts him personally in a lot of power with respect to Mr. Mueller. And I think all of this is of a piece. What happened with Chief Justice Roberts, what we're talking about with the media, what we're talking about with the Justice Department, and that is we are potentially slipping into a totalitarian state, an autocracy. The framers of the Constitution knew this was a possibility, which is why we have three branches of government. No one branch is the boss. There's no more kings. The other two branches need to check the other branch's papers. And as was mentioned, the Republicans have not done anything. So we have to hope that through the House and through potential whistleblowers and the criminal justice system and neutral judges and the voting public who need to step in and educate themselves about the implications here and not just be asleep at the wheel, because we're a 230-year-old democracy. There's no guarantee it's going to continue.
You know, the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away.
I began by telling the president that there was a cancer growing on the presidency, and if the cancer was not removed, the president himself would be killed by it. I also told him that it was important that this cancer be removed immediately because it was growing more deadly every day.
I know a man. He came from my hometown. He wore his passion for his woman like a thorny crown.
Just look at what is now being exposed in our Department of Justice and the FBI. Look at what's going on. There's a lingering stench, and we're going to get rid of that, too.
We went out on the street, we told people about Trump's plan to give the Statue of Liberty back. You know, France gave us the Statue of Liberty in 1886 as a symbol of friendship. So how would Americans feel about our president sending her back?
We're out here asking people what they thought about Trump's announcements of the French this week that he wants to give back the Statue of Liberty because he doesn't like the message it sends about tired and poor immigrants.
Well, I think that's, and I voted for Trump. I think that's a pretty low statement on his part.
Trump made the announcement to the French this week that he wants to have them take the Statue of Liberty back because he doesn't like the message it sends about giving your tired and poor immigrants. How do you feel about that?
Whatever he says, I think it's great.
Absolutely. I think it's a good idea.
It would take forever to take it back to France. I mean, seeing how big it is. So I don't see the point investing in a pointless transfer.
He said that green is hands down the most unflattering color on big women.
Green.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I think green is a weird color, so I don't know. I don't know how I feel about what you said.
Well, it would save the American taxpayers $1.2 million to retrofit the pipes in the White House if we melted down the Statue of Liberty for the copper. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, that part, I'm not really so sure. If he's going to do it, then if it saves money, that'll be good.
My love for you is so overpowering, I'm afraid that I will disappear. Slip sliding away. Slip sliding away. You know, the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away.
Secretary Mike Pompeo of the State Department talking about the president's and the administration's statement that was released this afternoon in reaction to the killing of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The headline of that statement was that the U.S. stands with Saudi Arabia despite allegations that the Saudi crown prince orchestrated the killing. You might remember we reported this yesterday, NBC News actually broke this on Sunday, that the CIA's assessment, their conclusion was that Mohammed bin Salman was behind the killing of Khashoggi.
It's all about, for me, very simple. It's America first. Saudi Arabia, if we broke with them, I think your oil prices would go through the roof. I've kept them down. They've helped me keep them down. It's a very simple equation for me. I'm about make America great again, and I'm about America first.
President Trump yesterday explaining why he is standing by Saudi Arabia, despite the CIA reportedly concluding with high confidence that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the killing of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. In a tweet this morning, Trump echoed that sentiment and went a step further, writing, quote, oil prices getting lower, great, like a big tax cut for America and the world. Enjoy. Thank you to Saudi Arabia, but let's go lower. In a statement yesterday, Trump dismissed the Saudi government's alleged role in Khashoggi's killing, saying, quote, it could very well be that the crown prince had knowledge of this tragic event. Maybe he did and maybe he didn't. But several of Trump's Republican colleagues on Capitol Hill slammed his defense of the Saudi regime.
I am astounded at the type of response that was put out by the White House. We have a crown prince that I believe directed the killing of a journalist. And the language that was used, it was as if they were writing a press release for the Saudi Arabia, not for the United States. And it was unnecessarily provocative in the way that he did it.
Here's what I believe. Saudi Arabia needs us more than we need them. It's not too much to ask an ally not to butcher a guy in a consulate. This is not World War II, so I'm not going to look away at what MBS did.
Slip sliding away. Slip sliding away. You know the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away.
He said publicly he would put Clinton in jail if elected. He wanted to use the apparatus of the state, the Justice Department, to stop his enemies. But does the fact that he was stopped matter? Does it essentially absolve him from any possible liability here?
Well, the question is, do we live in Venezuela or do we live in the United States of America? This is the behavior of people who don't believe in the rule of law. And the most interesting fact from the New York Times piece was that Don McGahn had said that the president had the authority to engage in an investigation, right? So remember, let's separate investigation versus prosecution. The president had the authority maybe to open up or ask for an investigation, but it would have been a staggering exercise in poor judgment to do so. Just because you have the authority to do something doesn't mean that you ought to do it. And it would have been an egregious violation of the rule of law for the president to start opening investigations of his personal opponents or his political opponents and so on. And so this is, you know, this transcends politics and sort of the normal, you know, Democrat versus Republican bickering about what's the latest thing Donald Trump has done today. And this strikes at the core of what law enforcement is and how it's used in the United States of America. This is the president attempting to use the prosecutor prosecutorial or investigative apparatus of the country as his personal hit squad.
In a rare statement, Chief Justice John Roberts from the Supreme Court today issued a stunning rebuke of the president for challenging the integrity of a federal judge. Began yesterday when the president questioned the independence of the judiciary, saying that a ruling against his asylum policy in the Ninth Circuit was due to, quote, an Obama judge. Here's Trump.
Your asylum policy has been put on hold.
Well, you go to the Ninth Circuit and it's a disgrace, and I'm going to put in a major complaint because you cannot win, if you're us, a case in the Ninth Circuit. This was an Obama judge. And I'll tell you what, it's not going to happen like this anymore.
Chief Justice John Roberts then took the unusual step of correcting the president, saying in a statement, we do not have Obama judges or Trump judges, Bush judges or Clinton judges. What we have is an extraordinary group of dedicated judges doing their level best to do equal right to those appearing before them. That independent judiciary is something we should all be thankful for. According to NBC News, quote, it's the first time the Republican-appointed leader of the federal judiciary has offered even a hint of criticism of Trump. Late today, the president responded to the Chief Justice saying, quote, sorry, Chief Justice John Roberts, but you do indeed have Obama judges, and they have a much different point of view than the people who are charged with the safety of our country, adding that, quote, we need protection and security. These rulings are making our country unsafe, very dangerous, and unwise.
I have brought peace, freedom, justice, and security to my new empire.
Your new empire?
His slip sliding away. You know the near your destination, more you slip sliding away.
The focus on the midterms, we haven't had enough time to cover all of the recent news. So here with a recap is one of our writers, Amber Ruffin, in a segment we call Amber Says What?
You guys, things have been crazy. Okay, first of all, the president boarded a plane with toilet paper on his shoe, and I was like, what? Then he couldn't figure out how to close his umbrella, so he just left it on the ground. I was like, what? Then a dating website for people who love Trump came out called Donald Daters. I saw that and I was like, gross. Then everybody was like, Kendall Jenner culturally appropriated an afro. And I was like, what are you talking about? That's not an afro. This is an afro. And then people were like, stop talking like that. And I was like, yeah. But really, that's not an afro. That's a white girl who slept at her boyfriend's house and had to use man shampoo. Then, people were mad about a Martin Luther King statue in Buffalo because they said it looks nothing like Martin Luther King. And I was like, how bad could it be? But then I saw the picture and was like, what? What? That guy looks nothing like Martin Luther King. You know who looks more like Martin Luther King? This guy. Then Oprah canvassed for Stacey Abrams in Georgia, and I was like, what? Can you imagine having Oprah come to your door and be like, what? Is this your house? Do you want my house? I'm sorry, I shouldn't have been in here. Come on, children, this is Oprah's house now. Then at a Republican rally, someone from Trump's cabinet described Florida's governor election as, quote, cotton picking important. I heard that and was like, what? Oh, you know what happened today? Idris Elba was named People Magazine's Sexiest Man Alive. And I was like, why does that sound familiar? Oh, yeah, here's why. Blake Shelton was named Sexiest Man Alive. And I was like, what happened to Idris Elba? Is he okay? Called it! And I'm calling next year's Sexiest Man Alive, Idris Elba. And the year after that, Idris Elba. And so on and so forth until he dies, at which point he will be Sexiest Ghost Alive. In other news, there is a Mandarin duck in Central Park and everybody is freaking out because it came from China, and no one knows how it got here. But it is the most beautiful bird I have ever seen. I saw that Chinese duck, and I was like, Shenma? Back here in America, white ladies have been calling the cops on black people for the stupidest reasons. She called 911 on a black man who was planting a community garden. She called the cops on a black guy who was entering his own apartment. And she called them on a 9-year-old child for just living. I read all that and was like, well, surely this can't get any more ridiculous. And that's when it happened. White people who were on a boat called the police on a whale! Look!
Fine. It's fine. It's right under us.
I'm out in Puget Sound, and there's three stray whales right underneath our boat,
yeah,
and
drive
I'm
away.
Afraid that we might get flipped
drive
over.
Away.
I'm
drive
really
away.
Scared.
I saw that! I was like, what? You can't call the cops on a whale when you're in the ocean. You're in his house. He should call the police on you. Now, don't get me wrong. If you come downstairs and see a whale at your window, please call the police. And finally, it is the end of a very long election day. So to Democrats, I just want to say, you campaigned hard, you registered thousands of new voters, and you had a lot of firsts tonight. First openly gay male governor in history. What? Massachusetts, first black congresswoman. What? Connecticut's first black congresswoman. What? The youngest congresswoman ever. What? Texas's first two Latina congresswomen. What? What? And the first two Muslim and the first two Native American congresswomen. What? 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 Yeah. And to Republicans, I just want to say, what? This man, Amber says what?
This is the Berkeley Signal.